I find it incredibly intriguing, those people who will... those who got talked into coming to talk about Vayikra. I mean, please. I do, but I'm not saying it today. Today I'm talking, because today I'm talking about. No. I'm talking about Vayikra. No, Zohar is the easy way out. That's easy. But I'm going to talk about Vayikra, and I find myself saying this every week that this week's parsha is boring, and it's been true for a while right now, and nonetheless, I want to try to think about some of the things which are here, and we're going to try to correct some, I'm not going to say misconceptions, but maybe lack of conception. Maybe that's more important. So it could be that the first thing that comes to our mind, again, it could be, maybe not, it could be the first thing that comes to our mind is that essentially what is a korban about? A korban is about trying to get atonement. Okay, I'm saying, as a first thought, it could be that that's what people think. What we're going to find is there's many types of korbanot, and maybe just in terms of language, and we're going to pay attention to language as much as I can today, that there is a difference between a korban and a zevach. Zevach literally means to slaughter something. The etymology, at least, of a korban sounds very much like it means to come close, likarev. Now, who was the first one who said that? It was probably much later than we think, even though it may have just been a given for some people. That of course, that's what the korban is. Now, when we start looking at Sefer Vayikra from the very beginning, source 1, 2, 3, 4, source 1 speaks about a korban ola. Korban ola is a burnt offering. A burnt offering is not for any particular sin. It, you know, maybe part of the way to look at this is sort of like when there's a building fund, right? There's a building fund in the shul. Now, depending on how bad or what you've done will depend on what your donation is going to be like. And the truth is that shuls should do that. If you've done something like really major, you need to do this. Something a little more minor, you need to pay this, and so on. So we don't actually market it that way, but I kind of wonder what would happen if people didn't have guilt. Would we be raising money that we would be raising otherwise? Now, obviously, I'm being a little cynical, but not too much, just a little. A korban ola is a burnt offering. It is not a sin offering. It is something where, as opposed to some of the others, where either the individual will eat it or the kohen will eat it, the korban ola goes completely up. Ola. It goes completely up to what's called a burnt offering. And the reason it's called a burnt offering is because it's completely burnt. And that's interesting. That's where we start. We start with something which is completely for God. And maybe that's kind of the distinction that I want to make. What about this is about us, and what about this is about God? And a korban is theoretically close. But a korban ola, I'm not going to have subsequently a holy barbecue. Right? And in Sefer Midbar, for example, we find on when the people are complaining about food, we have no meat, we only have, you know, this mun and so on. One of the surprising things at that point is they could have had a holy barbecue, but they didn't want that. They could have, we'll see some of the other korbanot soon, they could have had a barbecue and just do it in the Mishkan, and then the people themselves could have eaten, but that's not what they wanted. Apparently there they wanted something which was not holy, whatever word you want to use for the opposite of holy. But again, you only understand that when you understand that some korbanot are actually partaken by the individuals. This source number 2 talks about a korban mincha. So korban mincha is also an outlier for some people. Christianity has had a little bit of difficulty with this as well. I'll explain exactly how and why. Because the whole concept for them of the crucifixion is that Jesus died for people, and therefore the only way that sin is forgiven is by the flesh and by blood and so on and so forth, and that's going to be part of the sacrament and so on. Korban mincha is made out of flour. So there is no blood. It is an interesting conversation to have with somebody saying, oh, you know, again, for Christian theology, and we're going to come back to them a little bit more because they seem to have latched onto a little bit of korbanot. But the korban mincha, as I said, is a bit of an outlier because it is made out of non-animal products. I guess this is your korban for the vegetarian. There is a famous discussion by Rav Kook in his commentary to the Siddur, where he speaks about the Messianic age, where the korbanot, which are flour offerings, will replace the animal types of offerings, which, by the way, has confused lots of people as well into thinking they know exactly what Rav Kook says, and we've done this at length before, so we're not going to do it right now. But I will say very quickly, first of all, the first myth about Rav Kook, at least the father, we're the father and the son. I'm going to get into trouble now. Rav Kook, the father, at least, was not a vegetarian. And for some reason, people think that he was. Apparently, he ate meat at least on Shabbat and Chag. I don't think he ate it during the week. I have a son and daughter-in-law who are like this, at least theoretically, so they're constantly making a siyum. It's a Sudas Mitzvah as well. So if they come over and they see what's for dinner, so my son then is learning something, making a siyum, and a siyum fixes everything. So although Rav Kook, the son of Tzvi Yehuda, was a vegetarian, but nonetheless his father told him to be a real rabbi, he needs to learn how to do shechita. And he pushes him, he forces him. It's one of the letters that Rav Kook wrote to his son when Rav Kook was stuck in Europe during World War I. He actually was in Switzerland for a bit, and then he took a job in London. And while he was in London, I believe is when he wrote this letter to his son saying, you know, you have to learn Shechita. I mean, what's, you know, basic competence as a rabbi. The other myth about Rav Kook is the book that he wrote about vegetarianism, he never wrote. He did not write this book. His son and one of his students, who were both vegetarians, wrote the book. What they did is they actually went through all kinds of writings of Rav Kook, and then they created a book out of his other writings. But he didn't write this. And, you know, whenever you take things out of context somewhat, it always becomes much more interesting. And Rav Kook has multiple things he says about the third Beit HaMikdash, including that there will be korbanot, regular korbanot, not just the... So it seems to be that there'll be stages as far as he's concerned, but it's not because of what you would have considered. He writes that there is this verse which is used for the Messianic age, which the Rambam says we have no idea what it means, the lamb will lie with the lion, and so on and so forth. And Rav Kook says, well, that means that... the Rambam says it's talking about warring nations, which we're not going to talk about now. We're in a safe space right now, so we're not going to talk about that. But it's going to be that the warring nations will lose their hunger for blood, and that would seem to be what these verses are about. Stop it, just stop. And I heard what you're thinking. Just stop. And well, I understand it's common where you live. And. Rav Kook actually writes, the reason that we won't be bringing korbanot is because the Messianic age is when the world will be filled with knowledge. So all of us will be more elevated. But he also says animals will be more elevated, and they're going to evolve to a point where they have understanding and so on. So at that point, the vegetarianism of Rav Kook in the Messianic era it's not necessarily because we've evolved, it's because the animals are evolved, and at this point, the world filled with knowledge affects them as well, so it's inappropriate at that point to kill animals, which again, I think is a little bit different, because based upon this, then this wouldn't apply today. And one last point about this, Rav Kook, prior to World War I, wrote all kinds of very positive things about Europeans, even about Christianity, and about how essentially he saw that the world was moving towards perfection, and which was his general take on the world. We're moving, things are getting better rather than getting worse. And World War I devastated him theologically. He lost hope to a certain extent during World War I, and he writes in this theoretical book, wherever they took this piece from, about vegetarianism today. He said it's not a very good idea right now because, he goes, in Europe you have people who will value the lives of animals, their pets, more than they will human beings. Mm-hmm. Right? And he died in 1935. This is before... Right? So I'm saying that insight, what he saw, is really chilling. And as I said, all that will keep in the... No, he felt that pushing vegetarianism now will have a negative effect on people who will then, again, he felt that it was just some kind of evil that needed to be dealt with, and we're not there yet. We're not in this world where knowledge has filled up the world. By the way, during his time in London, there was some very interesting, he used to visit the art museums, and he felt that, I believe it was Rembrandt, he felt, was touched with the Spirit of God, which is, okay, there you go. But by the way, you can even see it in Rembrandt's students. You can even see his students had picked up some of that that light. He spoke about the divine light. Anyway, moving back to our Korban Mincha, the Korban Mincha, therefore, is somewhat of an outlier because there It's not flesh involved in it. We move to source number three, the imzevach shlamim korbano. So the shlamim is an interesting kind of a korban. That's to create peace. That's sort of, I mean, that's the kind of holy party that I spoke about before. I feel good. I won the lottery. You know, there's also korban toda, which is interesting. That's a Thanksgiving. That's the korban toda took the place. Sorry, was it has been replaced by when the person something happens and says a berachat hagomel. The berachat hagomel takes the place of the korban toda. But the korban shlamim, life is good. You know, I want to do something nice. I want to create more peace, as it were, between man and God, and that again is partaken by humans. But then it's not until we get to source number four, where Vedaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, Daber Ben Israel Lemor Nefesh Ki Techta Bishkaga, a nefesh, a soul or a person who has sinned. Bishkaga means, I'll use the word right now, by accident or maybe inadvertently is a little bit better. But at this point, I want to stop. I've heard people say that in Judaism there's no concept of sin, which is a little surprising because I know lots of Jews who sin. And I think that the problem that people have is more the linguistic one with the word sin. Sin sometimes seems to be very, very heavy in terms of the feeling. But I don't want to mislead all of us. There's certainly sin in Judaism. I think the big difference is going to be, and by the way, this has implications even in terms of the abortion debate. And by the way, I'm completely mystified in terms of abortion debate in America, why Jews line up on one side or the other when I don't believe Judaism is on either one of those sides. And it's completely mystifying to me. And I also think that the Jewish approach of towards abortion is far more complex and has far more opinions than I think that we would imagine right now. But how broad it goes is really what's interesting, and how different, you know, the conceptions could be in it. And there's a lot more to say about that. But part of the quote-unquote right to life is based upon Christian theology, which is saying is that the soul of this fetus is damned by original sin, and therefore the default is going to hell, and therefore the mother who had a chance to be saved, we don't care about the mother's life, and we only care about the fetus's life. So there is something, again, if you don't realize that that is energized by theology, then you're just missing the entire point. I don't believe that Judaism says that our default is that we are stained by sin, we're tainted by sin, and therefore we need to fix something, quite the opposite. I think we say during the prayers, Elokai, Neshama, Shenatata bi, Tohorahi, right? We're given pure souls. Okay, we then work to sully them as much as possible, but that's why we say that first thing in the morning, and then we have our, you know, yeah, okay, and then we have all day to try to work on that. You never know. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you schedule it. So it's interesting that our concept is a little bit different. Now, I want to say something which is very broad and inexact. But despite my saying it's broad and inexact, it's true nonetheless. The korbanot are not for sins. They're for inadvertent acts. Which means the person who did something deliberately, the korbanot, there's no price tag for that. It is for the world of accidents or inadvertent behavior. Now, that itself should be very interesting, and I think that needs to be explained a little bit more. But the person who thinks that, oh, what the korban is, you know, now fill in your favorite sin. You could take your Ten Commandments and check them off if you want, you know, which left side, right side, whichever one that you want to break, and say, okay, so which korban do I bring for that? So I'm going to say it again. For the most part, that's not where the offerings are. And that's also what's interesting in terms of Christian theology versus Jew, which means, yeah, you know, somebody can walk into confession and say, I've done this and this and this and this. That's great. And go home. But that doesn't work in terms of korbanot. There's actually a fascinating discussion which took place. Again, they did not live in the same time, but they did live in the same place. They were both rabbis in Prague. One was the Maharal, the other was the Nodeb Yehuda. The argument between them was if a person did tshuva, And I'm going to say right now, a person repented with real sincerity, and they have absolute, again, real sincerity. But look, I want to go backwards a second, because the world of sin, I'm going to say it again, is far more complex than sometimes we think. I know some of you think you're good at it, you know all about it. No, the world of sin is a little more complicated. So first of all, there is a legal aspect. So Lisa, this is for you. There's a legal. You practice law at all? Okay. There's a legal aspect to sin. And what do I mean by that? So there are a whole bunch of sins where we're told that this sin carries with it a death penalty. Now, you can then say, oh, therefore this person who did this is guilty of a death penalty. And by the way, that was maybe the most absurd thing in the whole discussion of abortion in Jewish sources, where Rav Yaakov Emdin, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, had a really bad day. And Rav Moshe said he said, wrote something that should never have been written. So he there was dealing with the case. What happens if a married woman had an affair and now she's pregnant? He goes, well, she should have been killed anyway, so the least we can do is kill the baby. Ooh. Rav Yaakov Emdin actually writes this. When you said what just now, because you wanted me to repeat it because you didn't hear it? Or is that a what out of shock?
No, I think I didn't understand.
No, you did. That's the problem. That's the problem. So, yeah, Rav Yaakov Emdin says, yeah, therefore abortion should be allowed in any case of an illegitimate child. Really? Well, Rav Yaakov Emdin had an interesting view of life, and he had his own printing press. Filtering. He had his own printing press. So, yeah, he wrote like every day. He was writing things and very, very prolific. To Rav Yaakov. Listen, he was very clever. He also wrote an autobiography, which if you ever read some of his autobiography, you'd be absolutely shocked. You would think his biggest enemy wrote it about him, but he wrote it about himself. Including temptations that he stood up for and things, and it's fascinating his autobiography. Nonetheless, Rav Yaakov Emdin is saying that this person should be put to death. Hold it a second, Rav Yaakov. If he was sitting here with all due respect, the only way that there's a death penalty is if there are two witnesses, and the two witnesses need to warn somebody. Which means I'm saying that's not just a procedural issue. That is one of substance and of essence, because it could very well be that if there were two witnesses, they're warning the person never would have done it, which means there's a lack of culpability because the individual wasn't warned, which means I'm not saying is that, oh, what can I do? I can only kill you if the witness is. No, it's not the same crime, which means we're punished for deliberate crimes. And what makes something deliberate? It makes it deliberate because I was warned about it. I know the consequences. I understand it. Not just a kind of a heat of a moment. I heard what it is. And by the way, now I'll go a little bit further. You know, we have the famous Mishnah that says a court that killed once in X amount of years or Y amount of years. And Rabbi Akiva says once 70 years. And Rabbi Akiva said, if I was on the court, I never would have killed anybody. Hold it. Rabbi Akiva didn't know how to read the Chumash. This person, mot yumot. This person, mot yumat. This person, yumot. He never read that. Of course he read it. But I'm going to say it maybe slightly differently than Rabbi Akiva had in mind. But if the only time that somebody could be put to death is there are two witnesses who warn the individual, and then the individual, right, will say, well, I don't care. If I were a lawyer, I would argue for insanity. Because they could have done it. Why are they going to do it now with their two witnesses? That's crazy. Which means if you're going to do it anyway, okay, fine, I got it, no problem. And then you wait for them to walk away, and then you do it. Why would you do a crime which is punishable by death in front of two witnesses unless you're suffering some kind of problem in terms of comprehension or capacity or anger or whatever it is? But anyway, I would argue for some type of leniency in such a case, because I think it's an indication of at least some kind of temporary insanity. So I'm being very serious about that, which then takes you to a whole different place. So then why do we have all these laws? Well, these laws then teach you values. And the values are important, but not that they're implemented upon. And there's this other thing about the Jewish legal system, which hovers over everything, and that is that we believe that there's a God who's going to actually do the judgment. And why do I have to do the judgment for God, which takes me back to the argument between the Nodu Yehuda and between the Maharal. What happens if a person was guilty of something where there were witnesses and the court found the person guilty and they're about to be executed and the guy says, stop, I did tshuva. Now, do we believe in tshuva? Do we believe in repentance? And the answer is, yeah. So the person did tshuva, so then why is he taken out to be killed? Don't we believe that tshuva wipes the slate? They did real tshuva.
Right at the end?
Yeah.
Right before
yeah. best time. Yeah. It's the best time. So does that tshuva work? Now, you know, every single rabbi giving a talk before Yom Kippur is telling you, yeah, your tshuva works. Everything works. It always works. So then why right now? Okay, that's kapara. So it's kapara. It's atonement. But so why should this tshuva not work? Okay, good. So that's the way the Maharal looked at it. The Maharal essentially said that God's court and man's court work two different ways. God's court is a perfect court, which can take in all kinds of considerations, and man's court can only follow procedure. And we have a different type of procedure, and that's what we follow. God would take other things in mind, and it could very well be that God would forgive this person. That doesn't mean the court can forgive them. So the Maharal's response is that these are two different realms. The Noda Yehuda, and by the way, the tshuva of the Noda Yehuda is a tshuva, which also, if we're already going after Yaakov Emden, we can go after the Noda Yehuda now. No, but him, it's not his fault. It's the person who asked him the question. This is the question of the Tzaddik Bal Tshuva. The Tzaddik Bal Tshuva who writes the question to the Noda Yehuda says as follows, while I was yeshiva bachur, I lived in the home, most yeshivas didn't have dormitories. I don't know if you know this. I think the first time that there was really a major dormitory and kitchen was the yeshiva. Well, Volozhin, I'm not sure about the kitchen. But was tells us a little bit late. Was actually Chachmei Lublin. Chachmei Lublin. That was the whole thing. Was that they said, no, we're going to build a yeshiva, dormitories, kitchens, and everything. So anyway, this person who contacts the Noda Yehuda says that, I was living with this family, and I had an affair with the wife. And then he says, and now he's married the daughter. Okay? And now he married the daughter. And then he says, but I've done tshuva, so should I tell the husband how bad his wife is? This is the question. And then he asks, by the way, what? And then he asks, yeah, right, because he's a tzaddik. So along the way, then the guy says, listen, and also tell me how I should do tshuva, but by the way, I'm very weak and I'm very frail and I don't have really, like essentially he says, you know, tell me to do tshuva, but I don't want to do anything hard. Yeah, please make it easy for me, but let me know if I should tell on her. So along the way, the Noda Yehuda does say that tshuva can forgive everything, and the only reason that somebody guilty of a death penalty isn't killed is because we don't know, which means God knows we don't know. So the Maharal said, no, these work in different ways, but the Noda Yehuda says, we don't really know, because anybody who's about to be killed says, oh, I did tshuva, I just remembered I did tshuva, and please, therefore, forgive me. But the Noda Yehuda was telling this person, who you can decide sincere or not sincere, but that sincere tshuva really does work in all kinds of cases. But now I want to go back. This is not about the whole world of korbanot. The world of korbanot is not about the person who did something deliberately. Now, when I said that there are exceptions to this, so one exception would be the service on Yom Kippur. The service on Yom Kippur does have this other magical element to it and does somehow create this atonement and cleansing and so on. So that's one exception. That's not an individual korban. That's something which is God forgives all of Klal Yisrael and you're included in Klal Yisrael and you have certain thoughts, so that can help create atonement. There's more to talk about Yom Kippur, so just hold on to that for a moment. On the other hand, there is one outlier which I'm not going to get into. And that has to do, you don't have this in front of you, so don't bother looking, because I decided not to put it in front of you. And I'm reading instead of the Mishnah or the Gemara, which is in Shavuot and Daf Lamed Zayin or so. The Rambam is in Hilchot Shavuot, Perek Zayin, Halacha Ched. Hanishba Shavuot HaPikadon, bemazed, if somebody swears regarding a vow that somebody left some kind of parcel with them, a pikadon, a collateral, bemazed on purpose, that he does bring a korban asham in such a case. So this would really be the outlier, although maybe this tells me something else in terms of human frailty. It may not have been a premeditated case. It could be that now something happened and now he makes the vow. Yeah, he did it on purpose, but it could be the situation. It's part of a larger context, And maybe that's what makes a difference. But anyway, this would be the outlier. This would be the one where it actually, the Rambam writes, b'mezid, he did something on purpose, and nonetheless there's a korban which is brought. But other than that, we are, I can then say, other than that, another Yom Kippur, I can say pretty much that all the korbanot that we find over here are all the sin offerings which are brought, or all the shogeg. So then that maybe that brings somebody to this conclusion, oh, in Judaism there's not really sin, it's something else, but it actually could be the opposite conclusion. So let me explain that as well. Most of Yom Kippur, from a biblical perspective, don't bother me with Jewish theology and don't bother me with the Mishnah and the Gemara and so on. Most of Yom Kippur, from a biblical perspective, is about fixing the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash from inadvertent tumah, which means essentially you had something which was holy, and you've misused that which was holy, and now I need to fix that which was misused. I now need to create a purity of the place. That is most of the Torah about Yom Kippur. The place has been misused. Tum'ah came in somehow. Now, here's something which is probably worthwhile thinking about. And again, this is pointed out years and years and years ago, but I think we are in a unique situation to understand this today. And that is the word chet actually has another word which is very, very close to it, and that is what lechato or chitui. What's chitui? Now everybody should know what that means. To sanitize. So how is it that the same word chet and the same word chitui, or again, it's coming from the same, it seems to be the same root. So to sanitize and to sin, that's real, that itself is fascinating. Because part of what Yom Kippur really is about is this understanding that God gave us a holy tool, a holy kli, a holy utensil, holy place, and we've misused it. We've misused it by making it tameh, and therefore I now need to fix it. So now, if I go backwards, part of Yom Kippur then also is going to be that God gave us another holy kli, and that is us, and that is our souls, our neshamot, and we need now to go about fixing that. But what's fascinating is that on Yom Kippur, it's the human being is really secondary to the fixing of the Beit HaMikdash that we have misused. And once it's cleaning, right? Once we're doing cleaning, now let's clean everything and let's clean the person as well. But I think the metaphor, and you all caught the metaphor, I think the metaphor is fascinating, and that is the misuse of something which is holy is in and of itself a sin. And unless you don't want to use the word sin, you want to use a different word? You want to say the word what? Unfortunate. Yeah, like the misuse of something is... Yeah, the misuse of something which is holy, it needs to be lamented. It needs somehow to be rectified. There's something over there that we nonetheless need to do, and maybe that's now going to help me in terms of this entire world of fixing sins that were done by accident. Because I can say again, on a legal sense, if I did something by accident, there should be much less culpability. Let's... Again, consider this. Is the world of sin the courtroom, or is the world of sin the synagogue, or for that matter, the Beit HaMikdash? I'm saying that itself, I think, is a very interesting question. And the answer is going to come out that the Beit HaMikdash itself is not for the deliberate, you know, I mean, that's almost like too obscene. That's what the courtroom is for. But on the other hand, we also recognize the courtroom is limited. Because the courtroom does not deal with historical truth. It deals with technical legal truth. And there's a very big difference between the two. Which means I can go back and say to that person who claims now to have an affair with that woman, maybe he's upset with his mother-in-law. Maybe she didn't make him his favorite food. Maybe she keeps butting in on his marriage. So if I was the Noda Bihud and this guy said, I slept with my mother-in-law, should I go tell the husband? I would say, do you have any witnesses? Well, there's no witnesses over here. So be quiet and walk away. Because there's historical truth and then there's legal truth. And legal truth has to do with procedure and so on. But over here, in terms of, oh, you're going to go tell somebody something, but there's no evidence to this, so therefore there's no evidence to it, then who said that ever happened? Right? Who said that ever happened? So, right, so how dare you go and destroy somebody's life because of what you're claiming happened? Maybe it's your fantasy of what happened. Maybe it's your imagination what happened. No evidence? Not interested. Yeah.
So
So let's try to put this in order now. One is that we got Yom Kippur because of this. So then ultimately, therefore, the Chet HaEgel was... we got Yom Kippur because of the Chet HaEgel, so therefore the Chet HaEgel was apparently a good thing, because we've certainly have needed Yom Kippur from year to year. By the way, that's kind of like saying that if it wouldn't have been for Haman, right, we wouldn't have Purim. So therefore, blesses Haman. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to lots of blessings for Haman along the way. I mean, Mordechai should be cursed, because why didn't he bow down? Like, what's the problem? And Haman on the other... By the way, if you really want to work that through... you knew it was going to... On the other hand, the money that Haman accrued, that he collected, at the end that's... Achashverosh takes, and then he gives it to Mordechai, and according to at least some commentaries, that money then ends up going to Esther's son Daryavish, who then sends the money over to build the second Beit HaMikdash. So therefore, we go back to the building fund. There should have been like a big sign of the second Beit HaMikdash, donated by Haman, built by Haman. So then again, you could say, blessed is Haman for building the Beit HaMikdash for us, for those donations.
It was an anonymous.
Yeah, so again, God certainly has a sense of humor. Okay, but going again back to our point now, as far as the Chet HaEgel goes, and by the way, that particular terminology is not easily found in the Torah. Chet HaEgel. Even though we use that all the time, so that part I'm disassociating from. Secondly, I didn't say that. Secondly, this idea of paying off, that Rashi understands the verses right afterwards. When God is forgiving, he says that you will then pay off in payments. That I'm not going to make you pay it off in one time. You'll be paying this off in payments.
But I'm saying
Yes. I'm not going to debate. I'm not going to argue it. I could go back to this point about the procedural issues. Were they warned? Were they told? Were they this and so on? So then, how easy would it be really for a court to deal with this? And you know, what exactly would be the law in such a case? So I think that all of that is interesting. But I want to move, because we've already had chet, and I pointed out the chet and chitoy, but I want to get to one particular thing. There is a whole collection over here of sins which are done, which are accidents because we were misinformed. Our rabbi told us the wrong thing. The nasi said the wrong thing. The beit din said the wrong thing. So therefore, I did something which is not God's will, but I didn't do this out of an act of rebellion. I did this out of some kind of an accident. And perhaps it's important for us to see the Gemara. This will help us moving forward. The Gemara is... First, we'll look at Source 11. It's Gemara in Yoma, talking about what the Kohen Gadol says when he walks inside. Tanu Rabbanon Kate, or at least when he's doing his Avodah. Tanu Rabbanan, Ketzad Mitvadeh, what is the vidui, the confession of the Kohen Gadol? He says, Aviti Pashati V'chatati. Now, what the Gemara is going to be concerned with is the sequence of those words. V'chein B'sir HaMishtaleach Omer V'tvadeh Alav Et Kol Avonot, Aviti Avonot B'nei Yisrael V'et Pishehem L'kol Chatatam. So therefore, again, that's the same sequence. Now, I deliberately didn't translate yet. What is Aviti and what is Pashati and what is Chatati? V'chein B'Moshe Omer Nosei Avon V'feshe V'chata. So we find when Moshe is praying, we find that same sequence. Divrei Rabbi Meir. V'chachamim Omrim Avonot Elu Hazdonot. An Avon... Can all of these I can translate as sin if it made you happy. Avon means something done deliberately. V'cheinu omer hikarete karete nefesha hi avonaba. And I would then say avonaba, the stain of the sin is upon the person. Psha'im elu hamoradim. Pesha is when a person does this as an act of rebellion. So some sins we do deliberately, and some sins we do out of an act of defiance. Right. There was a rumor that there was an individual who learned in one of the yeshivot in Brooklyn, if you want, I'll tell you which one. And what? Tell you which one? You don't need to know. Where it didn't work out. And they say that in Yom Kippur, he came outside the building, was eating like a ham and cheese sandwich and on Yom Kippur. Yeah. So that would be, you know, that's... delivered. By the way, good lawyer would get him off also. V'cheinu omer melech Moav pashabi. Okay. L'kol chatotam, what is chet, elu hashkagot. So therefore, the Gemara, right, it says, nefesh tichta bishkaga, which goes back to our parsha. Now the Gemara asks, "Ume achishit vadeh al hazdonot v'al maradim chozum vadeh al shkagot?" Meaning, is that really the way that you should do this? You start on the most serious thing, then I have to then start talking about accidents. I'm saying, God, please forgive me for the deliberate things, for the rebellions. Now I have to talk about the accidents. Elakachia mitvadeh. No, it's the other way around. Chatati aviti pashati. The sequence really should be the thing, God, please forgive me for my accidental things. And then please forgive me for the things I did on purpose. And please forgive me for those rebellions that I'm guilty of. So there is this argument which way that we should do this and what the conclusion should be. And the Gemara ends up saying that we go like the Chachamim, we don't follow Rav Meir. So the Gemara ends up saying, yeah, and we don't really care that Moshe Rabbeinu daven that way. Could be Moshe Rabbeinu daven as your Moshe. And that's really the conclusion of the Gemara. Now, I want to go back, because again, that's going to carry a lot of the things which are here, but let's go back to source number 5 now. We have a nefesh ki techata v'shama kol alav hu eid o ra'a o yada in lo yagid v'nasa avano. Right? O nefesh asher tiga b'chol davar tameh. Again, notice the issues of impurity over here. V'ne'elam mimenu v'hu tameh v'ashem. Now, the letters aleph shin mem is what I want to get to. Over here is v'ashem. So what does v'ashem mean in this context? We have afterwards, O nefesh ki teshavah levateh b'sfatayim. Again, v'nalem mimenu v'hu yadah v'ashem la'achat me'ele. So what does the word ashem mean? Or maybe the best example will be in Pasuk Yud Tet. Well, we're going to skipping a little bit over here. Yudala talks, or Tetvav talks about Nefesh ki tam'al ma'al v'chatato bishkaga. Mi'ila is to use something which is holy in an inappropriate way. But then it says, v'viyat ashamo. He brings his ashamo. So what is this asham? But the pasuk that we want to talk about instead is going to be pasuk yud tet, but we'll read a little bit before it. V'im nefesh techata v'astachat mikol mitzvah Hashem asher lo ta'asena. V'lo yada v'ashem v'nasa avono. V'vi ayol tamim minatzon be'erkacha la'asham el hakohen. V'chiper lo kohen shkigagato asher shagag. That's all accident. V'hu lo yada v'nislach lo. And now the next pasuk we have to read more carefully. Asham hu ashom asham la'ashem. Now, the reason we're focusing on this verse is very, very simple. Rina, when my brother was involved in publishing some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's books, so one of the things he said, he goes, you know, you'd find every now and then in his personal notes, there like this unbelievable Dvar Torah, unbelievable explanation. At the end of the page was, and therefore we want to say Mazel Tov to this and this family on the bar mitzvah of their son, which means it was something that he wrote, but he wrote it within the context. So, I mean, the little part of the bar mitzvah didn't always make it, and didn't make it at all, until they just cut those things out. So anyway, the reason that we're by this pasuk is because there's a bar mitzvah of a young man this week, and after his parents were pulling their hair out, what do? He has to speak by the bar mitzvah, whatever. So I had offered already, by the way. And my wife said, no, you have to do something, right? They drive themselves crazy. I said, tell them to come. So it took a couple days. So I said, what do you want to talk about? Anything in the parsha? Again, look at this parsha that he has. And he said, oh, I like that pasuk. So I said, let me guess why you like it. I said, do you like it because it's the same word 3 times in a row? Right? And he said, yeah. He goes, that's really cool. Look at this. So it's actually 3 different words. And or at least they're pronounced different ways. But let's take a look and figure out. Ashamhu, ashom, asham lahashem.
Say that 3 times.
Say it 1 time slowly. I'm having a hard time. I mean, and the glasses had to come off even to see this over here. Okay, so what exactly is this talking about? So let's start by looking at Rashi in source number 12. Ashom hu ashom asham. Harishon kulu kamutz. What does kulu kamutz mean? That there's 2 kamatzim, if that's how you say it. right? Under the Aleph, under the Shin, a Shum, right? If you're of proper Ashkenazic roots, then it would be a Shum. That would be the first one. V'ha'acharon, chetziyav kamatz v'chetziyav patach. So the last one is Osham. So now let's go back. For those of you who love Dikduk, you can have a field. You can have a field day right now. Harishon kulo kamutz shehu shem davar. Okay, this is. Okay. V'acharon chetziyav kamatz v'chetziyav patach shehu loshon pa'al. V'im tomar mikra shelo letzarechu, and then it says, no, we need this for whatever reason. But part of the issue is what exactly is the sham. In this case, take a look at the Targum Onkelos in 13. Ashamahu al chovatei dechav ashama yakriv kadam Hashem. So it's very interesting, his dancing back and forth between asham and obligation or guilt, actually. Chovatei would be guilt. Ashamahu al chovate, that the asham over here is due to the guilt which this person has. The Targum Yonatan, Korban Ashama, okay, that helps you a lot, actually, because that's going to fit in completely with Rashi. What's the first one? Rashi says, Shem Davar. So what is it? It's the Korban. It's the Korban Asham. If you look at Targum Onkelos now, Ashama, because it's the Korban Asham that you're talking about. Korban Ashama, who called the Achayev le Korban Ashama, Yaitei Korban Ashama, L'shmei da Hashem al Chavatei de Chava. I know that may have been a little hard for you, so look at the top of page 3. Korban Asham, who Kol Shenit Chayev, Shachata, le Korban Asham, Yavi Korban la Asham, L'shmo shel Hashem al Chavo, or Cheto, Shachata. So, part of our problem is what exactly is a Korban Asham. And I do want to point out that, get you back into this Yom Kippur mood, that on Yom Kippur, one of the first things you're going to say is Ashamnu. So when you say Ashamnu, what does this mean? And if you look at the various translations, they're going to translate it in different ways. Now, again, what are our, as of this moment, what are our possibilities? One possibility is that it means that I have to bring a Korban Asham. Right, that would be very technical. Ashamnu, I have to bring my korban asham, but that doesn't really work. What would be more likely is that I'm guilty. Ashamnu, I'm guilty. Now, the word asham may also be connected with Aleph Shin Mem, but in terms of geography, in terms of a place, and it's a place which is desolate. A place which is completely desolate, is that word would apply as well. And therefore, when a person says Ashamnu, some of the translations are going to go in that way. Some will say, I'm guilty, right? Ashamnu bagadnu gazalnu. And by the way, if you follow, bagadnu, so I'm guilty of begida. Gazalnu, I'm guilty of gzela. So what's Ashamnu? I'm guilty of right? But some of the translations, I think they're wrong. I do think it's very nice, very poetic, that I've turned my soul into a wasteland. Right, it's very evoking and it's very interesting. And the only question is it actually correct? Is it actually true? But I'm saying some of the translations in the, you know, they've all these booklets and so on about what the Asham. You'll look. Some will say that the word Ashamnu means a spiritual wasteland. No. Yeah, you didn't get that. You like that? Hopefully it scares him. But a couple more things about the Asham, and then we'll wrap up, because, you know, how much sin do you people want in one day, right? There are different types of Korban Asham. One of them, again, let's see how much we really skipped here, what we want to do. I do want to just point out one thing that we skipped. Yeah, let's look at a little bit. Let's do a little bit. You'll all know this is like the total cop-out for me. And this should have been completely predictable that I would do this. But it will be meaningful, I hope. And that is, let's look at our various use of language in Bereshit. Because now, you know that's the trick. You're in the Vayikra, next thing, oh, look at this, we're in Bereshit. So at least I'm going to tell you when I'm doing this. So look at source number 6. This is Avimelech when he kidnapped Sarah and then finds out, God then warns him, you're going to die. And he was not so happy about that. V'yomer Avimelech, mazot asita lanu. This is Avram. Kimat shachav. Sorry. I take that back. This is not the one with Avram. This is the one with Yitzchak. Sorry. Source number six is with Yitzchak. Kimat shachav echad ha'am. I always wondered why he named himself that. Echad ha'am et ishtecha. V'heveita aleinu asham. Now, if I would have translated, I would translate this. I would say, you've brought upon us. How would you want to translate asham? Guilt. You would have brought us guilt upon us. In source number seven, this is the brothers who now have been confronted by Yosef, and they don't know that it's Yosef, but they suddenly find themselves in difficult situations. Vayomer ish elachiv, aval ashemim anachnu. And again, I think that works as well, but we're guilty. I mean, you go back and you look at the Targum, that sometimes Asham sometimes is the korban, but sometimes it means chav. It means I'm guilty. I'm chayav. I'm guilty. Aval ashemim anachnu, but we're guilty. It's interesting what they say they're guilty for. Al achino ashereinu tzarat nafsho b'tchadano aleinu v'lo shamanu alkein ba'aleinu tzarazot. We're guilty because we ignored his cries and his pleas, and therefore this is happening to us now. Vayan ruvin otam lemor halo amarti aleichem lemor al techatu bayelad. Now, what does the word chet mean in this context? Don't sin towards the boy or Yosef. So over here, again, I think this is interesting that we're in the middle of Vayikra dealing with these words, but now you go back to Bereshit and you see over here that within two sentences we have, again, the brother saying, but we're guilty, and then I told you not to sin. Although it is interesting, I would have loved this to go one step further. I would have loved the brothers to have said that we sinned against God as well, which means God is missing from their formulation, both in the Ashamim and in the Chet, is we did something to him, and now we did. I mean, are they saying God is punishing us now? Are they saying it's karma? Or are they saying we're deserving, we're guilty? But there's no God in this, and that bothers me, because I would like religious documents to talk about God. On the other hand, just to compare this, if you look at source number 8, before you wanted Mrs. Robinson in your The Graduate, so now we have Mrs. Potiphar, where she hits on Yosef, and his response is, "Inin gadol ba'etzem imenu v'lo chasach imenu mu'ma ki imotach basher at ishto ve'echa sahara hagdola hazot v'chatati la'elokim." And this would be a sin against God. So Yosef is very interesting, because Yosef says there would be something wrong in terms of my relationship with your husband, my boss, because he has entrusted me, he's put me in a wonderful position, and I would be doing something wrong in terms of that trust, and that's the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, as it were, but on the other hand, it would also be a sin against God. So therefore, when I'm pointing out that the brothers are lacking, you know, that God consciousness, I would have wanted it. Again, if I'm writing the script of their speech, I would have put God into their conversation as well, and it's not there, but by Yosef it is there. And that is one of these things about Yosef. By Yosef, God is always on his lips. Even when he's the person in Egypt and they don't know his identity, he's still talking about God. And therefore Yosef becomes interesting. On the other hand, I don't know how many hands we have now, in source number 9, where Yehuda is trying to convince Yaakov to let him take Binyamin, he says, Anochi ravnu biyadiv tivakshenu im lo aviyativ elacha v'itzaktiv lefanacha v'chatati lecha kol hayamim. I would have sinned against you all of my days. So essentially, the brothers, okay, over here, this is being echoed. What we did to Yosef, we sinned against him. Over here, you just saying to Yaakov, I will have wronged you, but he's not talking about some kind of moral obligation in terms of God. He's only talking about an Adam L'Chavero, and the brothers seem to be talking about that way as well. If you want to argue with me on this, you can. But nonetheless, I find the conversation over here to be really interesting, because we have those words, Asham, again, which would mean guilt, and we have the words chet, which I do believe means sin. Are you going to argue that over here the use of chet is that it would be an accident? Again, chet is shogeg. So now, again, that then just becomes really interesting. Is Yosef saying that if you really try to seduce me, this will, he doesn't use the word avon or pesha. He goes, this would be a chet. So maybe this young man being seduced by this woman, and maybe he sees this as a chet, as a misstep, but more so than using those other words. And that's just really interesting. And you go back to your point that things never change, the world doesn't change. That's just so interesting. And I don't think we would have necessarily had that insight in terms of Yosef's language had we not been starting from Vayikra and look on how these words are being used. And again, the God element is essential, because essentially what tshuva is in terms of man and God, and the korban is man and God. And maybe that's the interesting thing about the legal system. Even the judges, by the way, are called occasionally in the Torah Elohim, because, again, there needs to be a God element in terms of fixing things, in terms of getting to some kind of healing. One last thing that I wanted to add about these korbanot. Look, if you look at source number 22, we could have done the Al-Sheikh, but it was so much longer. I've skipped over, but... One second. What I'm skipping over here is I gave you a dictionary, the Sefer in 16, the Sefer Shorashim of the Radak, which talks about the different usage of the word asham. If you go around two-thirds of the way down, on top of where it says, from Yoel, Perek Aleph, Perusho lefi pshuto shechatab arotoki yakonim ayum arim haTorah, ta'esham shomron, ki marta be'eloha. Ta'esham shomron, you may want to say it's the guilt of Shomron, but it could also be that it's become eradicated. It's become a wasteland. So sometimes it actually means wasteland. That over here, sometimes it is Shmama. Again, becoming a wasteland, and you can look at the various sources over here. The Malvim also goes into the different types of words. And in the second half of the Malbim, Shin Samachai, he also goes to all kinds of usages. And we'll leave it at that. Let's look at the last couple of sources now. In page 4, we have the Nitziv in source 22. Ashamhu. This is on our Pasuk. Shehu chayav l'shalem. Actually, let's just remind ourselves of the Pasuk one more time. And what it says is, Ashamhu. Ashom Asham LaHashem. So the Netziv writes, Asham Hu Shehu Chayav LeShalem. Kamo Shadam Chayav LeShalem LeChaviro Hu Balo HaMazeh. He has to pay. Kach Asham Asham LaHashem. Now that's the other, right? Da halava min haMakom Baruch Hu Kilove min haAdam. Ukedetan ba'avot and so on. V'znak b'zeh korban. V'karov lahazbir tam shehichmira Torah b'safek. Yoter min havadai biyoker korban shehu kamo kolchet asham shehu kal michet shemevi chatat umikol makom korban biyoker mechatat. So, this I'm doing without getting into all of the details and all of the discussion, but an asham sometimes is brought because you are not sure that what you've done was wrong. Well, that's an asham talui. So for example, if I have two pieces of meat on my plate, and one is kosher and one isn't kosher, and I eat one of them, so did I do something wrong? So on the one hand, you can say, maybe. On the other hand, the answer is yes. Now, what did I do wrong? So, but it's not necessarily eating the spiritual poison, right? But it's one which is, I didn't listen to God sufficiently, and therefore this is much more relationship-oriented than it is in terms of substance of evil. Okay? Because maybe I didn't eat something wrong. So if the price, and we don't pay attention to this almost at all, but the price that it would cost to bring a korban, meaning if we were to do this a little differently, we would have had to open up all the korbanot. By the way, look which ones are male, which one are female. Which ones are bigger animals, which ones are smaller animal. What's the cost involved for this particular, and what's the cost there? That, by the way, is a really important discussion. And once you do that, then you'll actually feel that you understand what's going on. So I'm just saying that there really is a way of understanding Vayikra. That's the right way to do it, but that's not what I wanted to do today. But he's pointing out over here is that the korban asham actually is going to cost you more money than the chatat is going to cost you. So just trust him on that. So he's saying, but why should that be? That if I did a sin for real, it should cost more money than if I maybe did a sin. So in Shulchan Aruch in Source 23, this is part of what should interest you. It makes it into the laws of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. It's actually Rosh Hashanah. The Rama writes, V'yesh l'kol adam l'chapes l'fashvesh b'ma'asav u'lushuv me'em eser t'imei tshuva. This is right after it talked about eating only pat Yisrael during the 10 days, and over here the Rama adds, you have to also do tshuva. It's not just a question of what you eat, what you don't eat. U'safek aveirat tzarech yoter tshuva me'aveir v'adai. If you were in a situation that you may have sinned, you need more tshuva than if you certainly sinned. Now, why should that be? That if you know you did something wrong, then you feel bad. Over here, what are you going to do? You're going to justify it immediately. You're going to say, no, I definitely ate the one which was okay. 50-50, you know, I feel lucky today. You know, there's no question I ate the right thing. Ulechein korban asham talui hu tzrach liot yoter biyoker mechatat. And that's exactly the reason why the korban is. And the Aruch HaShulchan, again, adds on this same place to this same law, he says not only are you going to justify it post facto, afterwards are you going to justify it, the Aruch HaShulchan adds, he again repeats the same thing, V'safek aveira chamur mi aveira v'adait v'tzarech yoter hitam tzut l'tshuva ki yoter mitcharet kishudeh. Again, all that is the repetition. V'od, and what's in bold, the ala safek masito hayetzahara yoter. The Yetzirah is going to have more success where it's not necessary. Yeah, it doesn't have a hechsher. I'm sure everything in it is okay. Okay, I'll stop. Yeah, vegetarian restaurants don't really need a hechsher. Yoter mi alva avadai ba'amru ke'ein b'kanavera ulachain tzarech yoter chizuk l'zeh v'abalat aher maseinoto. And he says that a person will be more susceptible to sin whereby that maybe it's a sin, it's not certainly a sin, and therefore it needs more tshuva, and therefore the korban asham is more expensive because it's something which is completely relationship. It's a teaching moment, and it's completely in terms of the relationship. And what you've done is, you know, again, your spouse says, don't do that, you know, that's bad for you. Oh, look, nothing happened. Yeah, but, you know, what happened? They're looking out to protect you and so on, and you're just completely ignoring this particular thing. So that's what's interesting. By the way, the bar mitzvah boy is going to talk about all kinds of things he did when he was younger, and he's going to when he was much younger, and he said, yeah, but those things were my father's responsibility. He goes, now that it's my responsibility, I'm going to be careful about these things. That was his takeaway.